The first cell phone was demonstrated in 1973 by Martin Cooper. You know what wasn't demonstrated? Shared plans. Over 50 years later, you can save on one line thanks to Visible. When you switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless Visible, you can get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees. No, really. You can look around for them. They're not there. Switch now at Visible.com. Save on wireless without the hassle. Switch to Visible today and save at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Join co-hosts Will and Brian as they break down the lore of a rich multiverse 50 years in the making in a lighthearted and beginner-friendly way. They cover everything from character creation options to tips for dungeon masters. There's something for everyone, no matter how long you've been playing TTRPGs. Find The Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
Beyond and hello, everyone. My name is Jonathan Dornbush, and this is a very special episode of Podcast Beyond, IGN's weekly PlayStation show covering all the latest and greatest in the world of PlayStation. And this week, we're covering spoilers, a lot of spoilers for Horizon Forbidden West. I am very excited. We try to do some fun spoiler casts with the big PlayStation releases, and I'm very lucky to be joined this week by narrative director Ben McCaw and senior writer Andy Katain from Guerrilla. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Of course. So obviously, as I've mentioned at the top, and hopefully if you clicked into this video or the audio version of the show, we are going to fully get into the spoilers of Horizon's story. I am going to hopefully pick their brains and ask some decent questions to learn about the creation of this world and this game that I love, and I know so many people out there in the audience loved as well. Obviously, if you have not beaten Horizon Forbidden West, pause the show. Go do that because you absolutely should, and then come back and listen because it's absolutely worth going through it, and then you can come back and find out more about it. But obviously, we're going to go into full spoilers, so just as that warning, don't click play if you don't want to be spoiled. But with that said, I want to jump into, there are so many things I want to speak to you both about, and I think, you know, we're speaking a few weeks after launch, so it's been some time. But first of all, congratulations on the launch and the acclaim, and I think the joy that I've seen from the Horizon fan base. It's been so awesome to see just sort of the audience and community really rally around what you and the team have done.
Thank you so much. Yeah. It's been super surreal.
Yeah, I mean, it's so gratifying to see the reaction of the fans, and just to see how people have connected to the story. Also, just got to throw out there how gratifying it's been to see what people have been doing with photo mode. It's just spectacular, and we love it.
Yeah, I definitely, since I, even though I, you know, beat the campaign, continuing to go through the world and just explore and you know, obviously trophy cleanup, probably my time is one-to-one spent doing things in game and spent photo mode time. So it's really been a joy to take advantage of this beautiful world and you know, find every amazing angle of it that's been created. And so much of it, though, that I fell in love with, especially going through the story of it all, was Aloy's journey and the character she gets to know along the way and that we get to know along the way. And so I want to jump into a lot of that with the two of you. I know we I spoke to both of you before the game launched around one of the story trailer launches. And one of the things that really stuck with me was the excitement you both shared kind of about the expansive cast and the way they related to Aloy's journey of her, you know, having this wanting to do things on her own, but realizing she needs to have other people with her. And now that we can, you know, talk about things in full, I was really curious of, you know, the decision to, obviously this is the next step in Aloy's journey, but what about, I guess, specific companions or specific points of view from the world did you really want to bring into Aloy's adventure in Forbidden West, either through companions or through villains?
Well, I think, you know, it's a world where we want everything to be reflected back at the player in some way. And so in that sense, it's also a world where everything in a certain sense reflects Aloy. And so whenever we were dealing with a cast member or a an NPC or a side quest, a lot of our thinking was, how is this connected to Aloy's journey to kind of herself connect with humanity? And what aspect of that character or that quest is going to trigger some aspect of Aloy's personality? I mean, that's sort of like our continuous like philosophy. So even when Aloy is going on an adventure that involves killing a lot of machines to help someone, which is kind of the basis for a lot of the side quests, that it's going to either make her think or feel in a way that she hasn't before, or make her or reflect some aspect of her personality, or have a familial relationship that she has to think about or to feel about. So that's sort of what we did. We wanted to make sure that every single one of those moments had that kind of resonance for her.
And in talking about some of the, you know, the main companions, someone like Varl, for instance, it just made a lot of sense to us to bring him back because of the connection to the Nora tribe and how he sees her as the anointed, but also as a friend and someone who, you know, he's worried about her. He's worried about the burden that she's taking on, and he feels the need to help her. And so it just made a lot of sense for us to bring him back and very early in the story, because he's the one who wants, out of all the companions, to be by her side and to help her shoulder that burden, even if she doesn't want it at that point.
And I think you've just touched on the first, I guess, live wire, you know, hit to the heart for me that I wanted to bring up, which, of course, is the Varl of it all. I've certainly seen some fan reactions online to it as well. But for me, I think I was sitting in my living room and I was playing with my partner. And even though she had not seen the first game, even she was like, how could they do this? It was just a shock for both of us. We were so enthralled, I think, with Varl on this journey. And Annie, to your point, he's there from the very beginning with Aloy, both in, you know, the wider Horizon canon, but also specifically in this game. He's on that first mission with her. I am curious about sort of the decision to, you know, kill off such a, I would probably say, beloved character, but also, you know, someone who matters so much to Aloy. What goes into the process of deciding to kill that character off? Did it come early in the story crafting, late? Were there other characters in consideration? Like, how does all of that come about, basically?
Well, I think you just hit the nail on the head. It's the most important character to Aloy in the story. And that's exactly what you want to take away. I mean, you know, I mean, I think sometimes we think about stories as things that make us feel good, but I think really they're things that make us feel. And, you know, and there need to be uncomfortable moments. There need to be difficult moments. There need to be tragic moments, or else there really isn't much of a journey. And I think, and that's not just for Aloy. I mean, that's for a lot of the characters, and a lot of the characters specific to Varl as well. I mean, everyone suffers when he's gone. So we really needed to bring the story to a low point. We really needed to make it matter. We really needed to make sure the stakes were there. And that was where we came to. And, you know, I mean, I think that happened very early in the process. I don't actually think that was something that it was certainly not a late addition.
Yeah, and to add to that, it's also what Ben was saying about the low point. You know, the very next mission, when you're talking to Tilda, and Tilda's presenting this plan of, you know, you might not like the options, but this is what we can do and we'll succeed. And it's really, that's because of where Aloy is at that moment. She's at this low point where she just lost her friend, she just lost Beta and Gaia, and she considers it for a moment. You know, she can't just outright say no, because what Tilda's saying is making a lot of sense. But it's also that grief and that pain she's feeling, and her reflection about everything she's gone through up until that point, that brings her to the decision to, you know, say, no, we will find another way. I have another idea.
That was one of the most difficult moments in the entire game to calibrate, was the was where Aloy was considering that tragedy as we go into the Tilda scene and the Tilda's vault. And one of the things we tried to do with some of the art in that vault is have it reflect that grief. And there's a lot of grief going on there, because there's the grief about Varl, but there's Tilda's grief as well, which is sort of part of that experience. And some of the dialogue that I'm most happy about in the vault actually has to do with Varl, either directly or indirectly.
Yeah, there's so many points. I think that art sequence in particular is one that really stuck with me. But there are so many points where there are those layers to what you and the team really pulled off with the storytelling here. The two of you and the rest of the narrative team, and obviously the whole guerrilla team. I think there are so many moments where you can look at a thing and be like, oh, well, this is, of course, about how Aloy is feeling. But it can also be so much more than that, and the other characters around her, whether it's in that art scene or even something similarly as explicit with her and Zoe, you know, having that moment of solitude and somberness outside after that's happened as well. They're so moving and so affecting, and they also, I'm curious if they're sort of is it just working with the wider teams, but to make sure those moments stick, but also knowing this is in the middle of a really big open action game where people are also very excited to go take on giant machines. What is the struggle there? Or how do you find the balance in that?
Well, I don't see it as a struggle to find balance. I mean, I think, like, you know, Aloy as a machine hunter is so baked into the concept, and it is still fun to go and tackle the dangers and the threats of the world kind of in a variety of different ways. I will say, you know, about that moment with Zoe, that was a moment that we knew needed to happen, but Annie was the one that really hit it out of the park with that. When she wrote a draft of that scene, it was just like blew us all away. And you know, I hesitate to call it one of my favorite moments in the game because it hurts, but it's certainly one of the best.
This episode of Podcast Beyond is brought to you by NordVPN, a great way to protect yourself online while also improving your overall experience while enjoying cyberspace. Are you tired of streaming shows, movies, or sporting events being unavailable in your region due to draconian restrictions that are based on completely arbitrary geographical boundaries in physical meat space? Well, switch your virtual location to a place where that's no longer an issue. The same goes for shopping. You can get the best possible deal on subscriptions, flights, hotels, and other goods and services like that from websites that like to play favorites with certain territories and currencies. Meanwhile, encrypted traffic protects your data from hackers, viruses, malware, phishing sites, and other harmful hitchhikers of the information superhighway. Though really, it's more of an information autobahn, because there is no speed limit with NordVPN. It is the fastest VPN in the world, so there won't be any buffering or lagging, and it'll stop your ISP from throttling your bandwidth. Isn't that nice? One NordVPN account can be used across 6 devices, which is great. My wife has been using our account to watch all sorts of awful British reality TV shows that aren't available here, like Argument Island or Half Naked Idiots Fall in Love, and everyone's favorite, The Worst People Just Got Married. Let's hear them talk about it. Shows that are so bad they're blocked in our part of the world for our own good, but luckily, NordVPN allows her to trick the internet into thinking she's in the UK, so she and her awful friends can shriek and howl and cackle at the TV while I'm trying to relax. I've been using my VPN too. You know what I've been using it for? None of your business. Yep, that's right. And thanks to NordVPN, my data is safely encrypted, all bundled up in a weighted security blanket of incomprehensibly complex math problems, and nobody can tell what it's doing under there. Data, you do your thing. I'll leave you alone. 1 month of NordVPN coverage costs less than a cup of coffee. Coffee can't protect you from cyber criminals unless you throw it at them or pour it on their computers, and you'll probably get in trouble for doing that. So get NordVPN instead. To get the best possible discount off your NordVPN plan, go to nordvpn.com/pobeyond. That link will also give you 4 extra months on the 2-year plan. There's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Again, that is nordvpn.com/pobeyond. And now, back to the show.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts, with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for 2 women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it. Or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz, and how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, I would say, you know, that scene was, it was difficult because you are grappling with all these emotions and, you know that the player has had access to the open world after leaving Tilda's place, but you've come back to the base at this point. You see that first scene with all the companions sort of still grappling with their grief and not really knowing what to do without Aloy there. So I was really kind of thinking about that moment and continuing that conversation that Zoe wants to have in private of, you know, what would they, how would they approach this now that it's been some time, since it might be some time since the player's gone back to the base, but also what would Aloy say in that moment? It's one of the few times, you know, that she really does open up and she admits her feelings about Varl and about how she's felt this whole time to Zoe. And that's a moment of closeness for them. It's that moment of grief that she couldn't really allow herself to have back in Tilda's place because she knew she was still sort of in danger. She had to figure out who Tilda was. So just making time for that moment to happen with Zoe instead just made a lot of sense.
Well, on that note, and after Ben mentioning it, Annie, I guess I have you personally to thank for those, you know, 10 or so minutes I just kind of sat on my couch, you know, a bit misty-eyed, just kind of there. It's a beautiful marriage, I think, of, you know, story and gameplay really coming together where you can just have that moment to, you know, the player gets the agency to just sit there if they choose to after that moment, to come back and to visit and sit and reminisce. And certainly after that scene, I took a minute and just sat there, and it was such a heartbreaking and I think really, really both specific but universal exploration of grief in that moment. And so I think, you know, what you and it was accomplished in that scene, it's really tremendous. So thank you for, you know, writing that scene in general. That's not a question.
Thank you.
But
well, that's also a credit to, you know, our art teams and our cinematic teams. Like we had this moment and we went to those teams and we said, hey, we want to carve out a space for Varl, for his grave. And this scene means a lot to us. So how can we, you know, convey that through the scenery that, you know, you can actually see Plainsong. We're not just talking about it. But yeah, so credit to those teams as well for that's where it really all comes together.
I'm just sort of getting chills again thinking about that moment in the Amethyst as you're mentioning it, because yeah, it's really a tremendous moment, and as you said, it leans into another aspect as you eventually get into Tilda and everything. And obviously I do want to touch on, I think the Far Zeniths at large is maybe a good place to go to and then drill down a little bit more specifically. Ben, when we spoke you know, during the preview before the game, you had spoken a little bit about how there's so much in this game that hasn't been seen yet, and you were really excited for people to be able to see that. And we have, and it the extent to which I think things really shifted for me, there's a moment early on after you've discovered Hades and all that, and you have that first encounter with the Far Zeniths. And for me, that was sort of a turning moment for the game where it was, oh, there is so much more to this that we don't know. And I feel like that really plays into something you've both spoken to me about, which is the mystery of the Horizon world and both the mystery for Aloy and the player of there is so much beyond our conception of what, you know, we've experienced so far. Obviously the Far Zeniths are a huge part of the story, but can you tell me a little bit about how you decided to integrate them into things, like where it felt like this was a good moment to place them as a first true introduction after the teases in the beginning of the game and in that first introductory sequence? How did you, you know, attempt to layer them in, I guess?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, it's funny because this is a term that gets thrown all around a lot in storytelling, but that quest is the inciting incident of the game. So, you know, sometimes we think of the inciting incident as something near the beginning, or, you know, it might be easy to think of it in terms of the blight that Aloy is trying to stop. But really, that's the moment in the game where all of the forces that Aloy is going to be up against sort of come together in one place and are presented for the first time. So that includes the Zeniths. Silence is there as well. And Beta. And in, you know, I wouldn't describe Beta as an antagonist in the game the way the Far Zeniths are, but she certainly plays an antagonistic type force to Aloy emotionally for a good chunk of the game. So that's really where, that's the point where the story actually really kicks off. Everything before that is kind of prelude, and everything after that is the struggle that Aloy has to undergo to defeat them. I will say I saw many, many versions of that scene in development, but when I saw the final version and I saw the Zeniths, how they just looked physically, I was so happy. And Eric in particular is just so awful and so menacing in that scene. And I was thrilled with the work that the art and cinematics team did on that.
And to your point about, I think the look is something that is so startling in that moment as well, because it is, they are unlike anything. Obviously we've seen incredible machines and the, you know, machinery that has been existing from the old world, but they have a distinct look and feel to them, and it's imposing because you don't know what it is. And the fear of that wells up in, I think, both Aloy and, at least for me, especially in a battle where you can't really hurt your enemy. It's a really great crafting of I think, proving how tough an opponent these guys are going to be, but also how unique they are in the world of Horizon. I am curious, obviously you see the Farzinus in the beginning of the mission for people who are just playing with Forbidden West, but there's, you know, larger connections to them within the canon. Maybe it is hard to pinpoint down, but can you talk to me a little bit about how the decision was to have this group, you know, be the main antagonistic force at the end of the day? What about them most interested you and Annie and the writing team in general about having them be something for Aloy to go up against?
Well, I mean, so this is interesting because part of this was developed during Zero Dawn, which was that we knew that there needed to be this colony around the Sirius star system which is the origin of the mysterious signal. We knew that, and we knew there had to be inhabitants of that colony, and we knew they had to come from the Odyssey. We knew all those things, but what we didn't know was like the personality of the Zeniths. And that was something that we developed more while we were doing Forbidden West. For me, I mean, I think it was really the fun part is the sort of aspects that are mirrored from sort of contemporary 21st century America that made that fun, right? That really this is a story about nobody specific. There's no specific people that we're trying to skewer, but that a story about the sort of immense inequality that exists today.
Yeah, and to add to that, I think, you know, another really fun part about writing for Far Zenith is because that was set up in Zero Dawn, if you knew where to look, you know, there's data point mentions that you mentioned the Odyssey, mentioned Far Zenith, but it wasn't really a big part of Zero Dawn's story, right? And then when you start Forbidden West, then you get into the first ruin and we introduce that it's Far Zenith from the get-go. It was just fun to work in those acknowledgments to returning players or players who kind of dig into the lore and find those tidbits but also, you know, finding ways for new players to make sure that we introduce this in a way that makes sense and is understandable. So just finding that balance of finding ways to acknowledge that this is something that you've heard about before, but is also something new, and we're about to expand, you know, this world. We're going to grow what it means to be in the world of Horizon.
Yeah, and really just two other quick points. So one is another thing that was fun to write about the Zeniths is they can speak in totally like contemporary ways. You know, the people of Horizon speak in a contemporary way. We try not to have it sort of feel like high fantasy or anything like that. But the Zeniths, I mean, they're from the 21st century, and it's like they just talk like some of the Gerard's lines are ones that I really like, where he's like, you don't need it, don't want it, you found it, fantastic. You know, he has this kind of corporate, slick kind of feel, and we really enjoyed that. And just one other thing, I wanted to just circle back to a point you made a second ago. Why did we include the Zeniths? I mean, it is something that's very different than the rest of Horizon, but we felt we needed that. We felt like the sequel, it can't just be what you've seen before, right? It has to be something else. We have to go in a different direction. We don't want to break the mold, but we want to make sure that the mold evolves. And I think the Zeniths are our answer to that.
Absolutely. And just to your point on the dialogue, I absolutely would not have been shocked if he had one-liners of like, guess we'll have to circle back on this after, you know.
Yeah. No, we love that stuff. Like the idea that they would speak in like corporate jargon is, yeah, totally. Totally.
Yeah. To your point, it certainly doesn't feel like there's any one, you know, parody of a human being of our time, but it certainly it can be extrapolated of our very technologically focused present, how these people could have been a part of that. Absolutely. And something I do want to touch on another thing you had mentioned there, but before we move off the far zeniths, I do want to mention, because of course, Anna, you had brought it up, Tilda, and sort of the characterization there, which is, I think, both brilliant in the writing and obviously Carrie Ann Moss's performance there really gelled together well. I guess on one hand, you know, obviously to maybe help people come to a little bit of an understanding on this, but of my own curiosity, did Carrie Ann Moss coming in on the role at all change some of the writing you did for the character? Did it change any approach to, you know, her dialogue or things like that? Or was it something that she came in and really brought out what had been written?
I think it's more the latter. I think one of the things that's, sorry, Anya, I was about to say the same thing. Yeah. But one of the things that's so great about her performance is that she has a really nice understated performance where you can feel things kind of seething underneath. And that is something that's what we wanted. But we didn't know exactly what form it would take with her performance, but that's what we got. And we were thrilled with it.
Yeah. I was going to say also that we did have an idea, you know, of Tilda and of her character in the beginning. And yeah, just seeing what how Carrie Ann interpreted that and what she brought to the role just made it that much better. Right. It's one thing to write the words on a piece of paper and you can kind of imagine the character in your head. But it's really once the mocap and the voice recording comes back that the character starts to feel alive.
She's also wonderful to work with, by the way. Just want to throw that out there. She was fantastic. She was just absolutely fantastic.
It's been something that I feel like I've seen both, you know, with this and the Matrix. Obviously, there's been a lot of Carrie Ann Moss, you know, sort of interview stuff at the moment, and the sort of passion she brings to her projects. I think I even, you know, saw her in a couple of things for Horizon, and sort of the excitement she had for learning about this character felt really true and excited and passionate, and it comes through in that performance. And I was curious of, you know, both of your and the wider team's approach to making this very emotionally complex villain, because at the end of the day, I think you can look at Eric and Gerard and they fit some nice archetypes of like people you just really want to take down because of their smarminess and their evilness. But with Tilda, you know, not just her presenting herself as a potential ally, but as we learn of her connections to Elizabeth and all of that, there is so much more that connects her to Aloy and so much more that then connects her to the player. I assume, and I'm just curious to hear a little bit more about the creation of that, that was a very key part of fleshing out this character, was to make sure she had that affinity for Aloy and Elizabeth.
Definitely. And what you were saying is exactly right. Having that connection between Tilda and Elizabeth and therefore Aloy's interest and the player's interest in the character, that's really key to Tilda's character and what sets her apart from Gerard and Eric, right? We really wanted to, of all the zeniths, focus on Tilda and her past and the mystery of sort of untangling that past that Aloy goes through as the sort of core experience of with the zeniths. So, you know, when we're looking at Aloy's journey and thinking about, you know, she's measuring herself up to Elizabeth and she wants to live up to that example, and then comes along a zenith who has actually known Elizabeth personally and been in a relationship with her 1,000 years ago. And what does that do to Aloy, especially in that moment of the story when she finally gets to talk to her, where she, you know, she gets to ask her, what was Elizabeth like? This is the first person she's been able to talk to who actually knew what Elizabeth was like in the flesh. So there's that curiosity, but there's also the caution and the wariness on Aloy's part of Tilda saying too many of the right things. It's all the things that, you know, at the beginning of the game, Aloy would have loved to hear. But at this point in the story, she has kind of realized it's not just about being like Elizabeth. It's not just about living up to that example. And Tilda's coming in and saying all these really nice things that maybe she shouldn't trust. So that was something we really wanted to look into and sort of dig into with the dialogue between them.
My favorite thing about Tilda is that I personally struggle to think of Tilda as a villain. I know that you fight Tilda, but everything that Tilda does is motivated by love. Now, it may not be what everyone would do with that motivation, but there is a very rational quality to it where, you know, she feels that she made a mistake and she's trying to correct that mistake. And in a certain sense, she views that she's trying to save Aloy's life and maybe give her eternal life. So I don't think, I don't know. I like Tilda.
I think she's we see her as a tragic character, right? She's motivated by love, as Ben is saying, but that it's twisted, or at least the way Aloy and the player sees it, it's a very twisted form of love. Whereas to Tilda, she's thinking, yeah, she's saving Aloy's life. She's making up for her regrets and her mistakes. And it's a good thing in the end. 100 years from now, or a few hundred years, whenever Aloy forgives her.
Yeah, well, that's one of my favorite lines, which is just like, you know, you'll feel differently about this in a couple hundred years. You know?
Yeah, it's, you know, to your point, obviously, it's easy to, I think, throw them in the buckets when I'm talking about these things, but villain can certainly, I think, be reductive of the work that you all did with Tilda, especially in that sense of, as you both pointed out, she's had 1,000 years to stew over losing the person that she loved. And so, yeah, there's, as you both said, it may not be the way we would act, but it's understandable what she's doing, you know, within the context of this game, and essentially asking Aloy to be like, hey, let's drive out of town to a different planet and find a place we can just be alone together. It's understandable, if not sad and perhaps a little twisted with the rest of the world's plight at the moment.
And one of my favorite pieces of dialogue with her that kind of foreshadows that is if you talk to her in the base before going on the final mission, she tells you about her relationship and her regrets, but she also says, you know, I made a mistake and I won't let that happen again. And then when you get to that final moment and you realize what she really means by that, you can think back to that conversation and see that that's really what she was talking about the whole time.
Absolutely. And there's one other aspect of this. And, you know, for those watching the video, you can see some of the late game scenes involving this stuff. I do want to mention, you know, before we run out of time, and Ben, you had mentioned it earlier with that opening scene, Beta and her storyline and sort of the somewhat, you know, beginning antagonistic nature of it with her and Aloy and really the heartbreak that comes with it. And as you learn more about her and Ashley Birch's incredible dual performance here of things. But I'm curious to hear from both of you sort of like what was interesting about creating essentially someone like Aloy, but not exactly like, and what were some of the, you know, most interesting writing challenges there or opportunities? What most interested you both and the team about this character?
Well, I mean, yeah. It was all challenging. I'll let Annie talk. It was hard. It was really hard.
Yeah, I was going to say it's probably the hardest piece of writing in the entire game in terms of wanting to get it right and trying to, you know, to go through all those iterations of figuring out who Beta is and how do we express that in the story, where she starts off as someone who is more, you know, butting heads and antagonistic with Aloy, but to get to the point in the pivotal scene where they sort of understand each other and start to see eye to eye, and by the end of the game see each other as sisters. So yeah, it was definitely the hardest part of writing for the story, but also the most gratifying to see it come together. And you know, one of the versions we had of Beta early on, she was actually a lot more optimistic and sort of spunky, I guess might not be the right word, but it's the word that's coming to mind, which you can actually see a little bit of that with her at the very end when she's back in the base. But that version of her just wasn't working out for the arc that we were trying to tell. And so then we kind of went back to the drawing board and thought about, okay, well, you know, what has Beta gone through? And really thinking about that. And it was really when we started to think of her as a sullen teenager and someone who's depressed and who will lash out, that's when it really started to click of like, okay, this is how we can express her insecurities and her fears, but also in a way that's understandable and it's motivated from her upbringing.
I think one of the hardest things was to locate the exact point of empathy in all of the scenes, because it's like, you know, it's easy to be empathetic for Beta, right? I mean, she's had a very difficult, sort of almost like tortured upbringing, And but we really needed the point of empathy to be with the player, to be with Aloy as much as possible, or to always understand what's going on in Aloy's head. And that was really the struggle of like kind of calibrating that perfectly.
Go ahead.
I was going to add I think a key breakthrough was when Ben actually had the realization that in that pivotal scene where Aloy has to convince Beta to go on the mission to Gemini, that it's really about unlocking Beta's potential and trying to convince her to go on this mission for good reason. Like, the player understands why you need to do this, but Beta doesn't, and presenting that as a challenge to the player, I think, is what helped, you know, build that scene and make it work.
And so much of I think that relationship and that scene in particular speaks to just a larger theme in the game that I really think is so beautifully done in terms of Aloy coming to terms with the idea that she can't do this all alone, that there are certain parts of this that she feels responsible for, but at the end of the day, she needs other people, whether it's, you know, another version of her to a certain extent, or the friends and sort of the makeshift family she has around her. You know, even with Beta, I think about how Varl was really responsible also for helping to kind of chip away at the walls that she put up with the rest of the team. And you know, there are so many characters we could get into, but I know we're short on time sort of with that group. But I was wondering, you know, just on a general note, and obviously what it means for you and Aloy's continuing growth and journey, her seeming to know that she can't do this all alone feels like a really big through line of this game. And at the end of it, she has this group who's working with her and helping to spread out to all these other tribes, both, you know, ones she's recently learned about and older ones. How important to you is it that this story is about more than Aloy and more than, or I guess learning that Aloy is more than just her focused, you know, directive, that she is part of a larger community and group and family of people working to save their lives. Is that something that feels true to where you hope the character grows both in this game and onward?
Well, yeah, I mean, but you know, one way of thinking about this is that, it's all part of a kind of coming of age story. I mean, you know, Aloy starts as, well, we literally see her as a child in Zero Dawn. Then we see her grow up quite quickly in one montage mostly. But then we see her go through the proving, and we see her lose her father figure. We see her search for her mother figure. We see so many of these things. And you know, and that's the first game. And in the second game, it's really about her really joining the world of Horizon, right? Because she's actually, you know, in a lot of the first game, part of the ancient world, and so is Elizabeth Sobeck. But this is a game that's really about her joining the tribal world of Horizon. But I will say, you know, it's a coming of age story. Aloy's only what, 20, 21? There's more to go. There's more to go, and there's more evolution there, a lot more, I think.
Yeah, and to add to what Ben said, you know, the heart and soul of this story is Aloy's relationship with Beta, but as you pointed out, her relationship with her companions and also the side characters like Hikaru and Deka that she meets through the main story and the side quests. And yeah, that's a huge focus for this story, and it's that was the chapter of her growth that we wanted to tell. But as Ben said, it's an ongoing story. It's an ongoing growth for her.
Absolutely.
Well, actually, what Annie just said sort of actually encapsulates, you know, the final scene, the kind of like epilogue, right? Because it's wrapped with Aloy and Beta. You kind of see that at the beginning and the end of the scene, and in between that are all the tribal components, the people, that, you know, what happened to the Quen, what's going to happen to the Tanakh, what's going to happen to the Osram, and even Moreland and his crew. And so, you know, and so that's, but it's all wrapped in this idea of like Aloy's no longer alone. So yeah, I mean, that's what we were trying to achieve. And you know, where we go next, I don't know, but I do know that Aloy still has growing to do. I know that for sure.
Absolutely. And speaking to that final scene, I think I could probably spend 45 minutes just asking you about something like the Quen alone and everything brilliant that works there. And just the brilliance in how short a time I grew to hate the CEO. from Minute One and how wonderful that arc is in such short a time. But before we wrap up, I just did want to briefly mention, you know, you mentioned Moorland, and the Sea of Sands level in particular is such a beautiful encapsulation for me of, I think, Aloy learning to work with other people, learning to hear their stories, learning what her current world is versus what the world used to be. And it's beautiful and brilliant and was another moment that got me choked up. Just with a moment like that, just to speak briefly to it before we wrap up. How obviously I think in this game, there is more of a focus on Aloy really learning of the relationship between the old world and her current world, more fully now that she has a fuller understanding of that. Could you speak just a little bit to about the creation of a sequence like that and how it speaks to those larger goals of wanting to marry the old and new together on Aloy's journey?
I mean, some of it is just so specific to what we wanted to do with Vegas, because all of this was sort of wrapped up in this idea of like, well, what can we show about Las Vegas that's new? Well, let's show it underwater, right? And that seemed to go really well with Poseidon. But then you can't do Las Vegas without thinking a little bit about show business. And I think that's really where the Moorland character came from. And that idea just kept growing as we kept writing and kept talking to the art and design teams, which was like, okay, well, if we're really going to do this, then we need these kind of mirrored things where you have the ancient past with Stanley Chen and how he created this beautiful city, but then couldn't quite let it die, and who would pick up the torch for that? And that's how we sort of got to Moorland and his crew. And it was just one of those things where I think here at the studio, we all just fell in love with the whole set of ideas, the physical nature of Vegas, those characters, also just the most romantic, and I say that in the sense of like positive a version of Las Vegas that we could possibly come up with. And then the performances, oh my God, like we scored with those three guys, you know? So it was great.
Yeah. I think also it really is a great quest to look at, to see when all the different parts of our studio are working, you know, at their top. We have the story, but we also have the art and the music, you know, both while you're exploring and with the Tide Ripper fight. I remember the first time I heard it in a playtest, I was like, whoa, it was so nice. But it's all those elements coming together. And I think it's a great quest to see, you know, you're always just gratified to see when all of those elements are working together and what kind of experience you can build from that. So yeah, it's a really great quest. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it is an absolutely gorgeous moment, you know, preceding, I think, so many of the incredible things that come throughout the rest of the game. And Ben, as you were saying, I could watch the three of those guys in like a half hour sitcom version of the Horizon world and just see what travails they get up to. It's such a joy. And again, with them or, you know, the Quinn and the CEO, I think the whole writing team, you all did a tremendous job of really quickly getting to the specificity of who these characters are and making us either love or hate them or understand their complexity throughout the process. So thank you both for, you know, diving into all of this with me and for, you know, letting me learn about some of the creation process of this and letting our audience as well. It's such an incredible journey the team has crafted, and I really appreciate everything you both have done.
Well, thank you so much for having us. And yeah, it's great to talk to you again. I feel very grateful. I've gotten to talk to you, I think, at least three times during this process. So it's been great.
Yeah.
And let's keep it up, man. Like, if you want to have us back, we'll come back.
Absolutely. The door is open anytime. It's a virtual door, but it is always open. And so many tremendous things. And, you know, just speaking to earlier about the incredible work of paying off what you did, what was done with Horizon Zero Dawn, the Far Zeniths, and the mystery of who sent the signal. I, and I'm sure many players, will be poring over every single data point in this game to find out what mysteries lie in wait. But in the meantime, thank you again, Ben and Annie, for joining me for this episode. Really, really appreciate all your insight and the incredible game that you and the team have made. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Happy data point hunting as well.
Thank you. I'll be up to it for quite a while, I'm sure. And thank you to everyone out there for listening and watching. We hope you enjoyed this special conversation about Horizon Forbidden West and hope you continued to explore it like I have. Please write into beyond@ign.com with some of your questions about the game, some of your thoughts. We'd love to read them on the show in the weeks to come. And I'm sure we'll be talking about Horizon a lot throughout the year because we can't stop talking about how much we love it on the show. But that is going to pretty much do it for this week's episode of Podcast Beyond. Thank you again, Annie and Ben. Thank you for joining me. Thank you to the audience out there for listening and watching. We hope you're doing well and we hope you're staying safe. And as always, beyond.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk turned traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.